Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon and welcome to Open Book. This is Alice Shelton. I'm joined today with my friendly co-host, Lori Strawn. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Well, it's kind of a gloomy fall day here. Is it the same at your place?
It's a little sunnier, but I know what you mean. We've had those gloomy days lately.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I was just thinking that it'd be nice to be home drinking a cup of coffee in my pajamas talking about Henry Nouwen with you. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to pretend that that's what we're doing.
Okay.
So anyway, most folks who listen to us with any regularity know that we, in addition to loving Thomas Merton and several others, we do love Henry Nouwen. And we've Henri Nouwen is how you pronounce it, isn't it, Lori?
I think so.
Okay. Well, I'm saying Henry Nouwen. Sorry.
That's all right. It's
offensive.
The Americanized version, and I'm sure he heard it a million times.
That's true. But anyway, we have a book at home that's been on the coffee table and in and out of the hands of people who are at our house called The Spirituality of Caregiving, and it's by Nouwen. And it just connected to me that I have missed reading some of his quotations, so I thought I'd select a few today for us to discuss. So these are not connected to any specific book or any really even any theme necessarily, unless you see a pattern emerge on theme. But I think the first one I'd like to read is very short, and it's on community. Community is the fruit of our capacity to make the interests of others more important than our own. Now, Lori, I've heard many definitions of community in my life, and this one is different than anything else I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, is this the way you would define community? Is this comprehensive enough? Is it focused in the way it should be?
I think it's a beautiful definition, but I honestly, when I first read this, I was a little conflicted because on one hand, communities are often or mostly like-minded, are they not? So, you know, the interests of others being more important than our own, certainly our own are part of forming a community, but they do require certain reaching out beyond ourselves in order to belong authentically. And I think what I keep coming back to is that word authentically, because you can belong to a community in a very put-on way by, you know, dressing like people or, you know, taking on the opinions of other people. But to really authentically belong to a community, you do have to sort of, you have to be real, for one thing. You have to be your true self. And you have to accept other people as their true selves. So I think it's beautiful, but I'm a little conflicted on it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful, but it's a little incomplete for me. So,
yeah.
I think worthy of thinking about. I like to think about things that are expressed in ways that either I don't think about or I don't necessarily even agree with, because it kind of expands my brain a little bit. So, well, I'm gonna tiptoe now into hospitality as a subject because I think it's a good flow from community.
Yeah.
Hospitality means primarily the creation of free space where the stranger can enter and become a friend instead of an enemy. Hospitality is not to change people, but to offer them space where change can take place. It is not to bring men and women over to our side, but to offer freedom not disturbed by dividing lines. So, hospitality, in my mind, is primarily something that I think about with regard to my home. But this seems to really broaden beyond that.
Yeah.
What other, maybe not aspects, but what other application for hospitality comes to your mind from this quotation?
Well,
like,
I am
what groups?
Immediately. Yeah, I thought of the Sisters of Providence, of course, immediately,
mm-hmm.
who do this so beautifully. Hospitality, true hospitality, can't be forced. It has to be like an open hand. It's accepted or it's not, without strings attached. I mean, it's just there, and you can take that hand or you can fling it away if you want to. And gradually, you feel who these people are. They don't have to say it. They don't have to, you know, indoctrinate you. You feel who they are. And as that hospitality washes over you, it's not that you're converted, but you understand them better. And sometimes mm-hmm. that can lead to a conversion of heart. Mm-hmm. Really, I think that the problem with hospitality is really only in what if somebody doesn't want to accept hospitality? You can't force it, I think, is the rub.
So how do you recognize it? I mean, is it a feeling that you get? Is it a set of characteristics?
Yeah, I think
it's every time.
A feeling mm-hmm. of being accepted, a feeling of we're glad you're here, which always surprises me because I never think anybody's going to be happy that I'm anywhere. But certainly something I feel with the Sisters of Providence is, you know, you get smiles wherever you go. You hear hellos and how are yous. And, you know, these mm-hmm. are people that maybe have never met me in their lives, but they're always open to meeting me. I think that's the big thing.
Do you think hospitality is the same as or like charism? Or what connections would it have to charism?
Mm. Oh, that's good. Charism is what draws you in. And hospitality certainly is part of what draws you in to a group of people. Feeling that comfort with them allows you to open yourself up to them and be changed by them in the process.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'd say it's a part of charism.
It's almost like, in some ways, it just crossed my mind that it's almost the expression of a charism.
Part of the way
of expressing the charism.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of those, hospitality is one of those things where you almost recognize, you know what it is when it's absent. You know, you almost recognize it in its absence and can define it more in its absence. It's kind of an interesting dynamic. But this quotation does give me some pause to thinking about really everywhere each of us goes, we are communicating some level of hospitality or being inhospitable if we're not communicating mm-hmm. it. I mean, you think about that as a personal space thing.
Oh, absolutely. I was just thinking, like, in the line at the grocery store, if a lady has a child who's crying, I try to always kind of smile at her and say, oh, it's okay, or engage the child a little bit so that she knows that it's, you know, we're not all standing here going, ugh, that lady and her awful child. You know, that she feels a little bit of acceptance where she is.
Yeah, that's so funny. I do the same thing. It's kind of like you just want to make them feel like you're at least one island in the great sea of people looking at them.
Right, right.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Well, it seems natural to me to go next, since we've talked about kind of community and hospitality, to go to compassion. It just seems like a natural step. So the next quotation from our friend Nouwen is, compassion asks us to go where it hurts, to enter into the places of pain, to share in brokenness, fear, confusion, and anguish. Compassion challenges us to cry out with those in misery, to mourn with those who are lonely, to weep with those in tears. Compassion requires us to be weak with the weak, vulnerable with the vulnerable, and powerless with the powerless. Compassion means full immersion in the condition of being human. So with these definitions or these statements about compassion, it feels to me like sometimes I think I am being compassionate when maybe what I'm being is sympathetic.
How would because you differentiate?
I think that you can have sympathy for individuals, meaning you can feel sorry for them without really entering what they're experiencing.
Okay.
Where for me, empathy and compassion are more equivalent. To empathize with someone, you really have to have walked in their shoes or experienced some level of similarity to their, but compassion even goes more deep. If you really look at this definition, I mean, compassion is really getting in there with people.
Yeah. Yeah, and that part is the hard part for me, because I do tend to kind of drown myself, you know, in other, being so tied up in how other people feel. And maybe mm-hmm. that's compassion, but it's also a very easy place to get stuck. And you mm-hmm. can't stay stuck. And sometimes it's easier to stay hurt than to move on. But the point of compassion is that it's a hopeful process, that
mm-hmm.
That there's humanity in hurt, but there's also hope because we're not alone. So you have to get
yeah.
unstuck. And that's my sort of my dilemma, is taking on, I can take on all those, you know, emotions and feel for people, but then you have to lift yourself back up and think, okay, well, now I have to move on, and I have to help other people move on too.
So you're feeling stuck in your own inactivity?
No.
I
feel like, oh,
okay.
my gosh, I know exactly how that person feels. I feel that hurt. I cry with them. I feel lonely. I feel all those feelings. But you have to do something with that instead of just sitting there crying. You can't just
gotcha.
Sit there and be miserable.
Gotcha. Well, what do you think, do you believe in the concept of doing small things to make a difference, kind of repetitively doing small things, taking,
yes.
you know, moving beyond that, and yes, you do?
Absolutely, and so strongly, just with recent events, the events in Paris, two things that happened that I noticed recently. I don't know, you're not a big Facebook girl, but I don't know if you've seen that little film of a man and his son being interviewed by a French journalist.
I've heard about it. I have not seen it.
Yes, and the little boy says, oh, it's, you know, there are very bad men, and they're going to come and kill us, and we're going to have to move. And the father says, oh, no, we're not going to move. France is our home. And the little boy says, yes, but they have guns. And the father says, well, they may have guns, but we have flowers. And see all those flowers over there that people are putting down? That's our protection against guns. And the little boy says, oh. And he feels better. And I thought that was a little thing that was big. And another little
yeah.
thing was the spouse of someone who had been killed came out in the paper and said, I can't hate these terrorists, and I won't. I refuse to hate them. And I thought, boy, just that one person saying that really reframed the conversation, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah. That's quite a witness, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet, you know, if you think about that, you wonder for families who've lost family members if they would experience that as a lack of compassion. I don't know. I'm just, it's possible they would, it's possible they wouldn't, but I think that type of response is holds a lot of power in my feeling. I mean, I think that's a way to really connect beyond the experience. We've had a lot of murders here in the city this summer and early fall, and we had a young woman who's a pastor's wife. Well,
yeah,
it made national
heard.
News that this woman was
yeah.
murdered. And, you know, the pastors at their church have come out publicly and said repeatedly, you know, we mourn her death, but we know our God will use this to make great things happen, and we don't know what those are, but we have hope in that outcome. And I think that's, I have a lot of commendation for people who have the strength to witness in that way, so especially so soon after a tragedy.
Yeah, but even the smallest, I think, of gestures, just putting down those flowers or lighting candles, can
mm-hmm.
be a huge step in healing for people who are despondent. And really, when you look at problems like terrorism and gun violence, they're too huge to even think about tackling in a meaningful way from just my little, you know, POV. So you have to chip away at them. That's the only way that you can stay sane. Looking at those kind of problems is to chip
yeah.
away by little kindnesses.
Yeah, I think you do too. And I think the other thing you have to avoid doing is becoming so, they're happening so frequently that you you can become immune to them. And I think those gestures, even done privately, are a way of guarding against becoming so immune and so hardened to the things that are happening. Yeah,
absolutely.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, yeah. Well, this next one, Lori, this strikes me probably more than any of the other quotations we'll do today. And this is kind of the imagery of what God has us doing here on this earth. It says, "This is what life is about. It is being sent on a trip by a loving God who is waiting at home for our return and is eager to watch the slides we took and hear about the friends we made. When we travel with the eyes and ears of the God who sent us, we will see wonderful sights, hear wonderful sounds, meet wonderful people, and be happy to return home." I think the only thing that I think is missing is that eat lots of great food is not in that list and should be. But, you know, it really impacts and helps me think about how I might change directions with my relationship with God and how I might begin to incorporate what my role is in God's eyes. Because, you know, I can think of myself as a tourist or a pilgrim. Pilgrim's the better word, where I'm really just I'm kind of the vehicle that's going to take this story back. What do you think about that? Does this feel good, bad, weird to you?
Oh, it feels wonderful. It feels comforting. I am certain that God is my most enthusiastic audience because I live so much internally. You know, there are going to be sad parts of your journey, but if you're looking for God, you'll find God, and that will make the sad times bearable. And just the optimism and the happiness of this quotation of seeing it as a wonderful trip, and boy, won't you be happy to get back home and relate all these adventures that you've had. It sure makes dying seem a whole lot less intimidating, doesn't it?
It does. It makes it feel like more welcoming, more just returning, just like it says, returning home, as opposed to going somewhere dark and scary and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've been missing my mom a lot lately, and I think you mentioned that your dad has been on your mind quite a lot. And I think some of the missing, this quotation speaks a little bit to it, and she's, my mother's not God, I know that. I think she's with God. But just that sense of, you know, you want to share stuff.
You
can't anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Today, for some reason, I was thinking of Ethel Merman. My dad always used to say, "Oh, Ethel Merman, I love Ethel Merman," but he really hated her. But that's the thing in our family is to love things that are unlovable, like horrible movies and the cheesiest 70s sitcoms. Oh yeah, we're big fans of those. And
that's,
you know,
hilarious.
Sort of in an ironic way. And I thought, oh, if only I could hear Ethel Merman. I could just see my dad smiling at that.
Oh, I know. Isn't it funny what we think about?
Yeah.
Oh, bless them. Good people. They're doing good stuff in heaven. We can be assured of that.
Yeah.
Well, I think the one I'm going to close with today, Laura, we're a little ahead of time, but, you know,
that's okay.
You might have something to add at the end. This one is about story and just the concept of story.
Mm.
One of the remarkable qualities of the story is that it creates space. We can dwell in the story, walk around, find our own place. The story confronts but does not oppress. The story inspires but does not manipulate. The story invites us to an encounter, a dialogue, a mutual sharing. As long as we have stories to tell to each other, there is hope. As long as we can remind each other of the lives of men and women in whom the love of God becomes manifest, there is reason to move forward to new land in which new stories are hidden. I imagine that you have listened to, or maybe even regularly listened to, the storybook show on National Public Radio.
Sometimes, when I get a chance.
Okay. But you have listened to it.
Yes.
Okay. So that was probably one of the first things that this reminded me of, and I really enjoy that program. I don't listen to it as often as I would like to, but I find myself just really drawn into hearing people tell stories, and it's mm-hmm. part of it's the way they tell it. It's what their telling of it says about them and their lives, or mm-hmm. doesn't say about themselves and their lives. So I really love this, and I think, again, it informs the way I think about God, because it draws me to Scripture differently. You know, if I look at the gospel as stories, I enter into that just on a more human level. It's a little more accessible to me, because it's kind of like the two of us sitting down having coffee, telling stories about college, or telling stories about what our family did, or you just telling the story about Ethel Merman. You know, that's how we relate to each other. And when you can access Scripture and teaching in that way, I think it changes it. It makes it a little bit more digestible. Now, that's a long segue there, but do you have any reaction to the quotation?
Oh, I love this quotation so much. And the first thing I, of course, thought of is that little bit, we can dwell in a story. Oh, give me a break. I walk around in stories all the time, which whatever I'm reading, you know,
you
right
are
now
a
it's
story.
Yes, I am all Flannery O'Connor all the time.
Oh,
I live in the books that I'm reading. And then two, the bit about the story invites us to an encounter, a dialogue, a mutual sharing, which always includes the opportunity and the willingness to be changed, which I think is huge.
Yep. Yep.
And I love the idea of telling stories as a means of hope and comfort. I mean, we do that anyway. Fairy tales, you know, that end happily ever after, you know, ongoing. It's something that we do generationally to transmit that means of hope and comfort. And also, I think he's looking at story in a larger way as sort of example. And I think his life, Nouwen's life, is sort of a manifestation of this idea of concrete instances of hope
mm-hmm.
prevailing through a relationship to God. Just
mm-hmm.
even the stories that we've told each other over the years, I think it gives you hope. It gives you reason to move on. It helps you move on in your life. And I think story is so embedded in who we are as human beings. I can't imagine being human without story.
I can't either, and I have had a unique perspective in the last 2 years with John's mom with us about stories, because as her memory has declined and she's aged more, her stories have changed in that they're not always taking place in the same place. They're not always taking place in the same time in her life. Sometimes the people are not always the same, but I can see that they're her stories, because the feelings that she's communicating stay the same. Her thoughts about herself and who she is stay the same. So it's been a really interesting process of understanding what is it in story that we're communicating. And I don't know what to say more about that, but it's just been an interesting process.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I love that there are certain core elements that remain the same. It'd be very interesting to study.
Yeah, I think it's something of the 100 million things I set aside every day that I think, oh, someday I'll write about that. It's definitely one. It's definitely it's a point of interest for me, because I think it says something about why we as human beings use story, even when
mm-hmm.
we have lost a lot of our ability. You know, it's a way of conveying something about ourselves beyond just the details of the story, I think.
Okay, now I'm going to get all sci-fi geek on you. Have you ever seen the episode of Star Trek Next Generation where Picard goes down to a planet and meets an alien, and this culture only talks in stories?
No.
For instance, Yeah. For instance, to convey sadness, they'll say like, if they were going to say something like doomed romance, they would say Romeo and Juliet in Verona. Or they might say Hansel and Gretel, breadcrumbs in the forest for taking a trip and leaving something behind to find yourself. It was all references to stories. And Picard has to learn how to talk to this alien, and he uses Gilgamesh, which is, you know, one of our oldest stories, to convey a friendship story to this guy who, I can't do the spoiler, but you have to see it sometime. It's my favorite Star Trek episode. It's all about story, and I love it.
Oh, that does sound interesting. It also tells you, I mean, we talk about this a lot. It speaks about the importance, again, of language and words and, mm-hmm. you know, what those things mean to us and how complicated communication is. And story communication in particular, I think, is, you know, there's a lot of, you have to assume a lot of information for someone to really understand your story because we all hear it through our own ears. Well, anyway, this is not a psychology show. This far as I know.
But it's a show about story.
Yeah,
very
it is.
Much.
It is. Well, I know I had a couple more quotations that we could use. If you wanted to do another one, that's great. Or if you have something else you wanted to talk about or ask.
You know, there are a couple more that are great, but I really feel like we need to leave it here. This is a good point.
Sounds good. Well, it's been good talking with you, Lori, as it always is. We thank those who've joined us, and we hope you'll join us again next week at the same time. We don't, Lori, I don't think you know yet what you're going to be talking about, do you?
I have an inkling, but I'm not sure it's enough.
Okay, well, keep working on that. And until then, if you're looking for God, just open a book. Have a great week.